Take your Bibles, please, and turn to Daniel chapter 5. We are in verses 13 through 30, so we're going to finish up the end of this chapter. I keep promising you that one of these days I'll teach you how to remember all of the contents of Daniel, but we'll do that one of these days, but not today. Today you have the privilege of listening to a sermon while right outside the door they're having lots of fun. Every so often the door will open and the wonderful hamburgers and brats and hot dogs, the smell will waft in. Love it. So we're going to finish up this chapter, Nebuchadnezzar's demise. Well, actually not Nebuchadnezzar, but his son. And it starts in verses 13, 16, where we are this morning. And first thing I've entitled this is Dead Man's Promises. Bill went to a very august institution, and whenever somebody was caught cheating, the guard would show up, and they'd march the person out of the dorm saying, "Dead man walking, dead man walking." I never went to any schools like that. It's probably a good thing. But that's what you have here in these verses, a dead man's promises. This guy is as good as dead. Let's look at verse 13. In that moment, Daniel was caused to be brought before the king, speaking, kind of fun how the Aramaic does this, speaking the king and saying, there was always participles. I can't just say something or having said something. It's always present participles. Speaking to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who from the sons of the captivity of Judah that my father the king caused to be brought from Judah? I have heard," we would say, "about you." They say, "I have heard over you," the reputation, the idea of a reputation. "I have heard about you that the Spirit of God is in you, and illumination and understanding and wisdom extraordinary has been found in you." And now they had cause to be brought before me, because he ordered them, the wise men, the astrologers, so that the writing, this writing, they should read, and the interpretation of it, they should cause me to know about it, make it known to me. And they were not able, an interpretation of the matter, to make public or to reveal. "And I have heard about you that you are able, an interpretation, to interpret, and enigmas, complicated things, to explain. Now, if you are able, the writing to read and the interpretation to make known to me, in purple wool you will be clothed, and the chain of gold on your neck, and ruler number 3 in the kingdom you will be." He's ruler number 1, probably his mother's ruler number 2, the queen. So in these verses you have promises given. You know the story. We're going to actually pick it up, a recap of Nebuchadnezzar and also Belshazzar. So even if you didn't show up last week, it's all right. We do learning here the same way they do it in school. We already had this. Well, you get to learn it again. Repetition, key to learning. So in these next verses, 17 to 21, we're going to get a recap of Nebuchadnezzar. And it's Daniel. And at this point, Daniel is really not very old. He's still pretty young. He lasted a lot of years through the Babylonian Empire and then on into the Persian Empire. Next chapter, we'll actually see him in the Persian Empire with the lion's den, and that's an exciting chapter too. But in that moment, Daniel answering and speaking before the king, "Your gifts to you, let them be," it's a command, "and your rewards, give to another. However, the writing I will read to the king, and the interpretation I will cause to make known to him. Interesting, there's no debate on Daniel's part here. He walks in, talk about an audience and a command performance. You know, the wise men have come and they're probably still waiting around. And here comes Daniel into this hall that's got at least 1,000 people in it, because that's how many noblemen there were there, 1,000 lords, plus all the other folks that were attached to them. So Daniel comes in. You, O king, the God Most High, the kingdom and the greatness, the majesty and the glory and the honor he gave to your father Nebuchadnezzar. So this is where he starts. He starts by saying, your father had greatness and glory and honor, and he gave that to him. And because of the greatness or the majesty that he gave to him, all peoples, all the nations, all the languages, they were in a state of trembling or terror and fearing from before him. Wherever Nebuchadnezzar was and his presence was, it was absolute terror. Whomever he was wishing, he was executing. Now you'll notice in all of the other kingdoms that follow after this, there's different ways of management. You know, but when you look at Nebuchadnezzar, he didn't have any laws that he had to follow. Why not? Well, because that's not how Babylon developed. Babylon was a band of outlaws to begin with. And the one who was the top dog made all the laws. And so that concept, the roughest, the toughest, the best soldier, he became the general and he became the king, and he ruled this nation with an iron fist. And when he conquered Assyria and then destroyed Egypt, that was it. He was a law unto himself. So whoever he wanted, he executed. And whomever he was wishing, he was causing to be left alive. So this one dies, this one stays alive. And whomever he was wishing, whatever he saw something, he exalted that person. And whomever he was wishing, he brought that person down. So his word was law. Verse 20. Whenever his heart was lifted up. I want you to pay attention to this verse, because it's a summation of the problem of Nebuchadnezzar. This is the first king of the times of the Gentiles whom God brought to himself, and he converted him for the purpose of an object lesson for everyone else. So, you know, God saved the chief of sinners. You realize that spot has been taken. No matter what you do, that spot has been occupied. Who occupies the spot of the worst person in the church age? Paul, the Apostle Paul. Yeah, that spot's taken. And God converted him as a model of his grace, that he can convert anybody. So, you know, you always have, as a principal, you have your worst kid in the school. Who's the worst kid in the school? Sometimes it's a tag team. But you have your worst kids. You try not to ever get rid of those. Why not? Well, because as soon as you do, then somebody else has to step up to take that place. And, you know, once you know who it is, well, now you round up the usual suspects and you're typically right. So when you look at Nebuchadnezzar, God did something special with him. He gave him a 12-month warning to fix his worldview. But look at verse 20. Whenever his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened for causing arrogance. Now, this may not be in your translation. I didn't even check mine. His spirit was hardened. And then there's an infinitive construct that follows it, for causing arrogance. So he had a problem with arrogance, right? And Daniel told him what was going to happen to him and said, look, you've got, maybe if you change your ways and start being a humble person, God will relent from the decree. And then a year later, there was something that snapped in Nebuchadnezzar. He made a decision when he was walking on the walls. Now, when you look in chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar is just recounts what he was thinking. When you look at chapter 5, you get a spiritual, divine perspective on it. So there's something that went on in Nebuchadnezzar's heart. It was lifted up. His spirit was hardened. And Nebuchadnezzar at that moment abandoned any attempt at being humble. It was hardened in arrogance. So apart from God, this would never, ever have changed. Nebuchadnezzar would have gone on from that day forward, day after day after day, being hardened in his arrogance. Have you ever met a very arrogant person and that was proud of their arrogance? They knew they were arrogant and there was no dealing with them because they're untouchable. Some of you are nodding your heads. Hopefully they're in a job, not in your family. But the arrogance that comes in to a person. I'm right. I don't care what you say. I'm not going to listen to you because I'm right and I know I'm right. Not willing to humble themselves and say, look, I was wrong. I don't know what I was thinking. Well, I do know what I was thinking. I was arrogant, and I'm so sorry for how I behaved. But the concept of doing that had escaped Nebuchadnezzar. So when you read chapter 4 and you see what he says in his conclusions, that the Lord is able to bring every man low, he's talking about himself. And that's why when you get into chapter 7, you'll see that he was given the heart of a man. He went from being a beast, incorrigible beast, to actually standing on his feet and a heart of a man given to him. So verse 20 is one of those things where it ought to be like the fellow on the road crew who has the unenviable job. If I have to build roads, I want to drive one of those big machines or at least a dump truck. You know, don't put me with the stop sign that you have to turn around or go. Don't put me there. I would go absolutely crazy. By the first hour, I'd be all done with it. You know, don't put me there. But this is one of those warning signs to us. Don't let your heart be lifted up. Don't let your spirit be hardened in this area of arrogance. It's a terrible place to be. From the throne of his kingdom and his glory, they caused him to be removed. Several direct objects here that we don't translate, but this guy, this guy, this guy, this guy, God took it all away from. His glory, his kingdom, his throne, he took it away from him. Verse 21, and the sons of man, of men, plural, they drove here. Again, this is cattle prod. They didn't have cattle prods, but they had whips. They drove him, and his heart was with the beasts. was made with the beasts. This is intensive. His heart, his person became with the beasts. Somehow in his heart, this change took place. And with the wild donkeys, his dwelling. Now, I had to change my flannel graph lesson. Because from a child, you know, growing up on flannel graphs, I saw Nebuchadnezzar during these 7 years in a nice wrought iron pasture with a little barn, you know, nice cute barn, open doors with red roof, and black wrought iron fence around it, and the circle drive around the wrought iron fence. And so they kept the king close and made sure he was safe. You know, they didn't let him mingle with the animals. They fed him there for said this. That's totally wrong. What's described here, you know, and in my mind's eye, I thought, well, maybe there was another ox in there, because this is really verdant pasture ground where they got the king in his pen, right? That is absolutely not what took place. They drove him. He says here, his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. Do you see that in verse 21? The donkeys, these wild donkeys, were animals that were living farther out from the domesticated animals. So you had a farm, you had your animals that were domesticated. What do you do with the animals that you don't want? You put them out there in the back 40, and that's where King Nebuchadnezzar was. The grass, like the oxen, he was they caused him to be fed. And from the dew of heaven, his body was caused to be made wet until he knew, till whenever he knew that a ruler, namely God Most High, in the kingdoms of men. Look at verse 21 here. This also caused me to change my thinking a little bit. I would have said previously that what Nebuchadnezzar came to understand is that there is the God in heaven Most High who rules over the kingdoms of men. But it seems to me that what Daniel is actually saying is slightly different, that there is a God Most High who is involved with the rulers of men. So he, the Most High God, is involved with this whole process of government. And he chooses whomever he wants and sets them over it. So it's a step back. It's a recognition that the kings are responsible to rule, but they rule in tangent with the God Most High of all heaven who put them in power. And I think that's an important change. All right, in verses 22 through 23, let's look at Belshazzar's sin. So we've seen him, dead man, making promises, and now we've recapped Nebuchadnezzar. Let's look here in verses 22 and 23 about Belshazzar's sins. And you, emphatic, his son Belshazzar, not have caused yourself to be humbled in your heart. So God humbled Nebuchadnezzar. He's the first guy as the object lesson. But Belshazzar, in close proximity to Nebuchadnezzar, he didn't care about humility. And all because of which all of this, notice all the words the Aramaic puts together. So we would emphasize this. How in the world could you not have known? So Daniel here is educating Belshazzar. I subscribe to a bunch of different channels on YouTube, and Ben Shapiro is one of the guys I like to listen to. And he sometimes shows clips of people explaining the obvious to other things. I think the guy that's now in charge of the Department of Defense during Obama's administration said to one of the generals that he was concerned that if they put all of those troops on an island, the island would capsize. Okay, this is now a guy who's in senior leadership under Biden's administration. And, you know, watching the general, this is why the guy's a general. All right, so this is an honest statement made by one of the political leaders. You know, well, you put all those people out there, all those troops and equipment on that island, it'll capsize. And deadpan emotion. You can see the wheels turning. How in the world do you answer this question? And after a long, dramatic pause, the general said, "That is not something we anticipate happening." And just moved right along. That's what's going on here with Daniel and Belshazzar. How in the world could you have been so stupid? You knew this. Verse 23. And over the Lord or ruler of the heavens, you have exalted yourself. You've caused yourself to be lifted up over the ruler, the master of the heavens. How did he do that? And for the vessels of his house, that is the Lord of the heavens, the vessels of his house, they have caused to be brought before you. And you and your noblemen, lords, your wives, your concubines, the wine are drinking from them. So if you were there, if you look at Lord number 743, who's on the 15th row back, you can see him reaching over and pushing the glass, pushing his wine cup from the house of Israel, pushing it over to his neighbor. Oops, you know, move that away from me. You brought them in and you're all drinking from them. And the gods of silver and the gold and the bronze and the iron and the wood and the stone, which are not seeing and are not hearing and are not knowing, you are praising. So here's his arrogance. Over the God of creation, the God of Israel, he goes and he gets those vessels from the temple for this grand and glorious celebration. And he's praising all these idols who have no hearing, no seeing, no knowledge. This is what they're giving worship to. And to the God who your breath is in his hand, as your very life is in his hand, and all your circumstances, all your ways are his, you do not honor, you do not glorify. So this is his indictment, his sin. Like his father, he exalted himself over the God of creation. In verses 24 through 28, I've just entitled this, "The Handwriting on the Wall." I mean, when do you get to preach a sermon where an idiom from Scripture has worked its way into the common language? Google, or whatever search engine you actually trust, Google handwriting on the wall, and you'll see how it's worked its way into our culture. Seeing the reduction in the research and development program, Bill saw the handwriting on the wall and began to look for another job. That's commonplace. This is where that comes from. Okay, let's look at the verses. Verse 24. At that moment, meaning going backwards in time, because of what took place previously, from God before him. And I think this is actually God who the hymn is referring to, sent the back part of the hand. So look up here. The Aramaic is the back part of the hand. That's these fingers. We call this the back of the hand. They call this the back part of the hand because it's further away. And if you want to have this discussion with Mrs. Effa and me about whether it's the front of the storage container or the back of the storage container, we can have that discussion. Or whether the East Coast is ahead of us or behind us, we can have that discussion. But it's worldview kinds of issues, always fun in a culture. But God sent the fingers, which Daniel is calling the back part of the hand. They were sent by God, and this writing was written. And there was written, again, I explained this last week, but this is engraved. So if you could imagine the scary part of this on this wall here, made out of brick, all of a sudden, you know, 2-inch wide grooves start to appear, and fingers holding the stylus as it grooves into this, you know, and dark lines, dark writing on the wall. That's what took place. So all of this is visible to everyone. Way cool stuff. You can't make this stuff up. Verse 25. And this is the writing which was written. Mene, mene, tekel, u pharsin. So mene, await, await, to be weighed, the u is and broken or divided in two, broken in two. So u is the conjunction, and pharsin. Mene, mene, tekel, and u pharsin. This is the interpretation of the message. Interesting. Daniel reads it, and here's what it means. All right. Mene. Your kingdom, God has counted. Mene is a weight, or weighed, if you would. And the fact that it's repeated in Hebrew means it's emphatic. He examined it thoroughly and counted it is the tekel, to be weighed. So examined and weighed it up and counted it, and it has been weighed in the balances. That's the tekel. So he looked at all of your kingdom, he examined it thoroughly, and he weighed it all out, and it has been thoroughly examined. And the last one, Upharsin, and you have been found deficient. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where you have to tell somebody that their child is academically behind, but I've learned experientially you don't ever use the word deficient. You know, that's common when you get out of high school. You have academic deficiencies. And everybody knows you have academic... Hello, Pete. Let's all blame Pete for that. he's good for it. You have academic deficiencies. So I finished a 4-year master's and I applied for a doctoral program. They examine all my transcripts and they say, oh, you have academic deficiencies. You have to go take a correspondence course on apologetics, which really amounted to me reading a few books, you know, and writing a paper. That's, you didn't have a class in your 4-year master's labeled apologetics. And that's a prerequisite for the... So, you know, academic deficiencies. This is a very significant finding that the king has been found deficient. All right? So now the last part here in verse 28. Pheres, or Perez, it is divided. And again, this is emphatic. Like you would take a block of wood and hit it with a splitting maul and it goes into... two pieces. It is divided, your kingdom. It is given to the Medes and the Persians. So this is the interpretation of what it means. And now let's look here in the last verses here. An unnecessary death had he changed his ways and followed the wisdom God gave to his father, this wouldn't have happened. At that moment, speaking, Belshazzar spoke and told him, and they clothed Daniel in purple wool and a chain of gold around his neck, and they proclaimed over him at that moment that he's ruler number three in the kingdom. All right, in that night, he slew him. Now, in my English translation, verse 31 is part of this. In the Hebrew translation, it's not. So the he isn't actually explained until the next verse, and I'm only going through verse 30. I'll take the explanation of who Darius the Mede is next hour. And that very night, he slew Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans. And like the kingdom was split, that emphatic nuance, so Belshazzar was slain. Now, I looked through the annals of history to see if I could find anything relating to how they executed Belshazzar on that very night. I couldn't find anything more than what's just stated, but the tenses that are used here are emphatic. So my guess is Darius the Mede, who diverted the Euphrates River, came under the wall while they are having this party and conquered the kingdom of Babylon without firing an arrow. His soldiers came in with all of the, I'd like to think this is what happened, with all of the lords watching, and they split Belshazzar from head to toe, split him in two. That would fit the language of what took place. One guy, one king, one execution, and there is no longer the Babylonian kingdom. So what do we take away from this? Gentile rulers should heed the writing on the wall. That's the point of this. Anytime you get a ruler, be it Africa or America, who somehow thinks they're independent of God, the creator of the universe, who is at work in that government, anytime you get that, the king should read, the president should read the handwriting on the wall. Because when God looks at this whole thing, he may thoroughly examine the kingdom and determine that it's lacking and divide it and destroy it. That would be the history of kingdoms during this whole time period and in our current day. All right, let's pray. Father, we thank you for what